And I would like to thank you, Michael Woodward, for having so generously accepted to come to speak to us, in spite of his being, as everybody knows by now from having seen the poster, always under pressure. And we hope that these 2 hours you will spend with us here will offer you the opportunity to relax a little bit. Yes. And thank you all for being here, students and colleagues. This is a special occasion for our students used to read and reflect upon many aspects in books to learn something about how they are actually made. I hope some of you have followed my prompting to see the amazing exhibition in which works at the Musée des Beaux-Arts this summer and beginning of September, in which works printed by Michael Woolworth and his workshop had a special place, the fantastic rug by José María Sicilia among them, a lithograph originally created for an exhibition at the Louvre, where he has also shown prints by other artists made by him and his studio. Before introducing Michael Woolworth to you, I would like to place this talk in context briefly, in the context of our research group and of our master's program. In 2011, thanks to a generous grant from the Terra Foundation for American Art in Chicago and Paris, and with a group of colleagues from Paris universities, the founders of Double Change in particular, I have organized here a symposium on artists and writers making books together. We call that the art of collaboration. Focused on transatlantic exchanges, that symposium brought together American poets such as Bill Bergson, Charles Bernstein, Vincent Katz, and artists Susan B., Peter Soriano, Shirley Jaffe, translators and publishers, rare book collection and art museum curators from Bibliothèque Nationale, the Bauhaus Museum in Weimar, and the Berkeley Museum. The actors of the book's long journey into the world, from its conception to its conservation, spoke about their experiences and helped us better situate the history and the role of artist books today, a pivotal one as I like to look at it. The contributions have been gathered in this volume, Artist Poets Books, published by Kyle Schlesinger, proprietor of Cuneiform Press in Victoria, Texas, with the joint support of our research center, Eribia, and the University of Houston. An artist book, as you will see from Michael's presentation, is not a book with pictures, but the result of an elaborate process in which authors, a writer, an artist, and printer, publisher, sometimes binder, work together. And I think this is an important aspect we very rarely think of the important contribution of publishers such as Michael to the, not only to the material fabrication of the book, but to the conception of the book. Since 2015, one of my master courses in cultural studies has focused on varied forms of collaborations for artist books in particular, grounded in my belief that artist books as creative forms are extraordinary ways of bringing together literature and arts and crafts, and that these peculiar objects, which we often handle or not so much, and read otherwise than we do other books, highlight enhanced perceptions of both text and images, of holding and reading, of touching and being touched, and thus restyle our understanding of literature and visual art, how printer and artist test the possibilities of form of the medium. I believe that studies in creative collaborations and artist books can play a role in studying literature and the arts as intersecting and mutually enriching practices, and that relating the object book to the mental object we may make of it in reading, the interpretation we call it here, to the process of its making is a way of better understanding the work, the creative process, and how the making of books or artworks brings people together. Ultimately, what human qualities collaborations exercise, what emerged, for instance, from our exchanges on that occasion was what in the introductory essay I have called, maybe a bit idealistically, a poetics of human relationships, which surfaces as a constant pattern involving qualities such as self-effacement, humility, forms of sociability, attention to the other, acceptance, curiosity, admiration, generosity, and Michael is a great example of generosity in many ways, reciprocation, risk, and even creative compromise. A whole range of encounters and collaborations issued from that conference in 2011, as had been my initial wish. And this is how I came to meet Michael Woolworth, who not only makes original prints and publishes artist books, but also hosts in his working space readings, mainly of American and French poets, in collaboration with our colleagues from Double Change. I only wish we met before, for he would have made a great team with our other guests, but things happen eventually, if they are to happen. That space, the workshop, which you might get a glimpse of in the presentation and also on the site, is absolutely amazing. The old printing presses from the 19th century and early 20th century used to print all sorts of things, champagne labels, among others. The odd tools, the objects hanging from a wall or a beam, books on shelves and or in piles, and yes, of course, pots and jars and bottles of pigment, ink, dyes, and maybe other secret ingredients, rolls of paper, brushes, sponges, trestles and tabourets in Jackson Pollock dripping patterns, and the sink. The sink is a kind of vortex of the workshop. I think of how many hands, working hands, have washed there, and brushes, and how much that sink has seen. And of course, the drawings and prints on the walls all around, sometimes fresh from the oven, spreading the aroma of pigment in the air. And Michael, the host, among a host of swarming workers and audience, always good-humored, enthusiastic but demure, jovial but intimidating, imposing, and not only on account of his stature. Born in the United States, Michael came to Paris in 1979. After working a few years with Frank Bordas in his lithography studio in 1985, he opened his own workshop, which has developed a variety of activities since, making original prints of many kinds, lithography techniques, as well as woodcuts, linocuts, monotypes, etchings, and multiples, all exclusively on hand press and presses. And he also produces editions of artist books, some of which he will introduce to you, the books they're making and speak about their making, and the books in the making, very soon, as I have finished. Michael has also opened the doors to his workshop and brought to light works of major artists such as Armand Mata, Jaume Plensa, Jamel Tatak, Marie-Ange Guéminot, that of artists who are related to our collaboration projects such as Jim Dine and Peter Soriano, and that of Gillian Gelzer, our former colleague from the École des Beaux-Arts, whose work have been shown in parallel with the XXL exhibition at the Beaux-Arts Museum. Holistic art has been at the center of artist communities such as Bauhaus or Black Mountain College. But Michael Woolworth, even as he animates that beehive of wonderful artists, writers, painter, is a total artist and an orchestra man by himself. He hosts readings and talks such as the ones I mentioned, but also organizes events in galleries, museums, bookstores, and has founded and contributed to art fairs throughout the world. He founded one in New York and in France, and over the past years has created the MAD, Multiple Art Days, art fair that brings together artists and publishers of artist books. His commitment to the art of printing, and counting by the many young people I have seen in the studio of passing it on, equals his commitment to bringing people together, creating opportunities for new projects. He is, in other words, the beating heart of art printing in France at present and hopefully for a long time in the future. Michael Woolworth is actually French patrimony, since his amazing activity has been recognized with the titre de Chevalier dans l'Ordre des Arts et des Lettres in 2011. That same year, he was honored by the French government with the title of Maître d'Art, and in 2012 recognized as part of France's living heritage, Entreprise du Patrimoine Vivant. The UNESCO patrimony title must be underway, and I would wholeheartedly grant him that of ambassador of transatlantic exchanges. Although I think that when it comes to it, Michael cares more about what he's going to print tomorrow, or maybe even tonight when he's going back to Paris, than about titles, and is by now impatient to share some of his experience with you. Please welcome master printer Michael Woolworth.
My God. That was very impressive. Did anybody understand anything there? That's great. I'm very honored there, Anka. You're pouring on the sauce a bit. But hey.
I didn't have time to say as much as I wanted to say.
Okay. It's lovely to be here in this city of Caen. Who are you all? I mean, I know that you follow Anka in the courses and everything, but how much do all of you know what an artist book means? Obviously, you know what a book means, but thank you. But an artist book is sort of a different thing. And maybe we can approach all of that and see what I can make, you know, define out of my head and convey it to you. Yes, I came to France in 1979 to give a little bit of history. I was a young nothing, and I was 18 years old, I was almost 19. I came here after my first year in the university in the United States. After freshman year, I did what everybody does, or some people do at least. I went on a trip to Europe, and I landed in Paris, and that was the first stop. And back then, well, the American reflex was to, during the summer of holidays, to find a job. You would find a job so you would live a bit in the community and get some money to have some pocket money to go back with or to pay your travel during that specific summer. And I was in the liberal arts college system, meaning in the United States, the first 2 years, freshman, sophomore, you do kind of general studies. You don't choose where you're going. And I had absolutely no idea what I wanted to be or wanted to become. So here I was in Paris looking for a job off the plane, and it was my first reflex was to go. My French was okay, but wasn't that great. Was to go to the Les Halles area in Paris on the Rue Saint-Denis area, because that's where there was a whole accumulation of American bars and American restaurants, to try and be a dishwasher. I know I'm going a bit far away from artist books, but that's what it takes sometimes to get to an artist book. And I started applying to jobs there, which turned out to be one of my major fiascos in life. Everybody refused me, nobody wanted me, which is fine, but I was a little bit taken back. So somebody I'd met, who was a French painter, said to me, "Well, there's a young man your age who just opened up something called a lithography shop, printing shop. He's alone, he's very overwhelmed, this is 79, he's a year older than you, and it looks like he might need help." So I was introduced to him fairly quickly on. And that was the man you were saying before called Frank Bordas. And he was totally French. And we started working together, you know, early July or something like that. Well, and worked through the whole summer. And by September, it was so good, I just never went back. I stayed the rest of my life, and I'm still here today in France, and still here in Paris also. And I learned the trade directly in a professional context, in a professional environment. And I think one of the things that, for a young whippersnapper that I was, who didn't know anything about anything, I mean, I didn't even know what print meant, in the sense that something like this, I didn't even think that it was actually printed. For me, it just exists. It just existed. You know, it's just something in society that I didn't think that there was a process behind it. Well, I kind of learned quickly that there is, and that was quite a stepping stone to figure out your life. And after all, what do you do studies for? Is to kind of figure out who you are and where you can go. For me, it stopped really, really early when I was 18, and I abandoned everything and became a printer, became a publisher. In a sense, I always found that I was very lucky. I was very lucky to have found something that I could really sink my teeth into and that I would really want to aspire and develop throughout my life. And it's still the same case today. Also, I'm from a family of 8 kids. And when I told my parents that, well, I think I'm going to stay in Paris, they were like saying to me, oh, really? No, you're not going to do that. And I said, yeah, I'm going to try this out. We'll see what happens. And after all, my father, well, it wasn't so bad for him. Because you know how much it costs education in America? So 1 out of 8 that he didn't have to pay for was not so bad in the end, you know, so he reluctantly accepted to let me try it out. He did force me to take one trimester as of that first semester at the American College in Paris. I was sort of interested in going towards geology, and so I took a geology class in the American College, and that was ridiculous. I mean, that was just completely of no interest whatsoever, although everything that they were saying was wonderful, but it just had no meaning for somebody like me. I was getting so involved in the printing thing that, you know, that's, you start making your choice in life. So what is a print? What is an original print, which is very different from a print? You have to understand that I only work with original prints. I only work with artists, visual artists. And our story is that we bang our heads together to try to make an image work. And to make an image work isn't always simple. My place is very close to what my mind is, what a recording studio used to be in music, you know, where you have several entities all working together to create the musical piece. The sound engineer, the musicians, the composer, the producer, and everybody is all concentrated to get this piece out. It's the same thing. Except for we're just doing visual stuff. What I can do is making things on the wall that you hang on the wall, or I can make books. that's pretty much the two options that I have. Because I'm only doing it by hand, I can't make posters. Posters, you need production. You need, you know, you need firepower. And in my case, everything is about slowness. It's a huge enterprise of slow cooking. And books, which are the slowest of them all in production, can sometimes take 3 years to make. Some of them took 4 or 5. A book can take 1.5 years easily when you start. It's all about a whole other geological time set, if I can put it that way. You have never perhaps seen a etching studio before. They have some presses down there in the bottom floor of the Musée de Caen, and they do workshops there occasionally. And they use some of the same presses I do. What I wanted to do today was, yes, talk about books, but also talk about an atmosphere and a spirit of how we put things together and what we live every day in the shop, because it's intense. It's a whole constant battle for creation with the artists. I'll have 1 or 2, rarely 3, artists working at the same time during the course of the day on different compositions. A composition, which is an image, in my place, can be used, can be treated with several techniques. We have about 5 or 6 printing techniques with the different presses that we have in the place. The art of printmaking. You either have etching, which is carving into a metal plate. You have lithography, which is drawing on a flat surface, generally a stone. Yes, you draw on a stone. And you have woodcut, which is going into a piece of wood, carving into a piece of wood, or linoleum. You might have done that when you're in maternelle, where you go into a piece of linoleum and you make an image. Or we use monotype, which is making one image at a time. You can't multiply it. Or photogravure, when in the case that we're employing photographic stuff. Now, the artists that we work with are so diversified, and I choose them. I choose the ones that interest me to come to the shop, because we need to move into money and economy, which is highly important in all this. This is a business. I run a business, and it's got to work. There are several people who are employed. There's several salaries. We have a monthly overhead, so things have to work. And it's really complicated in contemporary art to make a business figure. But we're still here, so something has worked. The way I do it is I have two forms of economy, the long money and the short money. The short money is what I take in contract orders. I take in contract orders, commission pieces, where a client, a gallery, a museum, a company, or sometimes the artists themselves who self-publish will pay me to do the job, 30 copies, 40 copies, 100 copies, whatever. And they will take the whole printing run and they will commercialize it themselves. That's the short money. That's what pays the bills mostly and the salaries. And the long money are all the investment I make on inviting artists that I am interested in. that I'm fascinated by, to explore the medium, because the way we print is not about reproduction, it's about using a medium. And this medium is, nobody really knows it, and most of the artists that I approach have no idea at all technical stuff. So it's all about, you know, teaching them and accompanying them in their first first printing stuff, and after that, I'm publishing this, so I offer it for sale, and people come in and buy it at my place, and obviously that money is more interesting for me because we're selling it at the normal price of a print. And so my balance all year round is about making sales of the stuff I publish and printing for other financial entities. But when I print for the other financial entities, it's doing the same thing. It's doing the same, working with sometimes even the same artists, but other new artists that I kind of say, okay, we can do this. It doesn't change at all the practice or the method or the result. It's just that I'm not the publisher. Somebody else is, and somebody else is paying me for it. You see what I mean? You know, all these artistic things are really great, but it's really important to understand the money part. How do you make it happen? Who? What's the difficulty in it all? Because we're always confronted with that. And since there is very little money, it's about constraint. We work with constraints. We work with the idea that, okay, we can't put 17 colors into that image. That image has got to work with two colors because we only have so much money to be able to invest in to make a two-color pass. Do you understand what two colors or 17 colors means? Have you ever done silkscreen? Have you ever done whatever? Doesn't matter. In other words, when you have an image like here, for example, this has two colors. The yellow is the color of the paper. The red is one is the text and that image, and then there's a white pass behind. So you pass the white first on a separate matrix, and then you pass the red, two colors. And that, you know, takes so much time, takes so much involvement. When it's 17 colors, which we never do, or very seldom, that'll take 17 more times. So you work with constraints, and constraints with artists is for me extremely important. They just can't get away with murder. They have to think out the construction of an image with economy, a form of economy. You have to make it work with two, three, four passes, or one at times. And that's all about the discussion. Understand something that's extremely important with somebody like me is that I am not an artist. I do not paint, I do not draw, I don't make videos, I don't make installations, I don't care at all. I am strictly a publisher and a printmaker, and that's what interests me. What interests me is a collaboration. That's why I accept to earn so little money in this business. To live a life alongside the artists and to accompany them in the voyage. And after, you know, and we all become kind of compagnons de route, they would say in French, and a kind of a strange family that's all thriving to make it happen. Am I making any sense here? Is it okay? So what we have is as I was saying, two different ways of making things, either a book or an image on the wall. Books, I started right away making books or being involved in making books. And that was great. There's nothing better than getting involved in a book adventure. Because it's a grand ensemble, you know, it's a real hefty project. Not that the others are not. Like when you do a whole series with somebody of 10, 15 pieces, it's a voyage and it's fantastic. But a book is different because you have the extra parameters of the fact that it's, you know, it's closed, it's an object, it's an architecture in our case, and you turn the pages. Turning the pages is really what it's about in my case. We try and make books not in the sense of a collection. Like they're always the same size, the same number of pages from one artist to another. No, because it's the object is the book. It's not an idea of collection or anything like that. We work each time, each different artist has a different concept of what a book might be. And I'll accept it or not, and we'll modify it or not as we go along. How do you make a good book? Well, it's really hard. It's really easy to make a bad book. And it's extremely easy to slip into something where you stop caring. If you stop caring, you're screwed in terms of books. I don't know if my books are any good or if all of them are exceptional. You obviously do your best and you try and make it happen somehow. But thus, since that's one of the things we can do, we knock our heads together with the very singular fact that myself, I am not literary at all. Of course I read books and I've read all the different literatures and stuff like that, but I'm not a literary guy. I'm strictly a visual person when it comes to my approach in my business. So all the books, without fail or without exception, all start with a discussion with a visual artist. Painters generally, but they're not only painters. And so it stems from there. And they can include text. And we can even work with writers eventually, or text. But it doesn't start necessarily from the text point of view. And I brought here, which I don't know if we'll have time to look at it or not, I brought here the sort of flagship, the vaisseau amiral of my studio, which is the project of the 1001 Nights. The 1001 Nights, which started in 1995, was created as a lifelong project with this one artist, who's a Spanish artist, called José María Cecilia, Spanish artist who's used to be in France and is now back in Madrid in his home city. And we started that in 95 as a something that would be a book project to last forever, as sort of parallel to the concept of the 1001 Nights. And the idea is that we need to make six deliveries, six different versions of this book, which I'll explain a bit better later on. And we're at number four. We're at number four, 25 years later or something like that. And so now we're working on number five, which might come out in 3 years, and the number six in 15 years. By then, we hope to still be standing, essentially. And it is a very particular book project that's extremely illustrative of the style of work or the mentality that we have at my place. Maybe I should start showing some pictures, no? What do we got here, Anka? What do we got? So this system here is going to be lovely. I brought a whole slew of images that are not necessarily about books, but it's about people, that artists that work with me or the workers at the shop, and they to show you how it is as much as possible. You are all, of course, invited to come by anytime you want, if ever you're in Paris. We are on the Place de la Bastille, and it's very easy to find me. Well, easy enough. If you want to visit, it's not a problem. Now, if I take the first image, it's not going to be any good. If I take the second image, it's going to be too small. If I take the third image, that one looks pretty big. Yeah.
Well, you can enlarge them if they are smaller.
Nah. Now let's look at a film. That would be fun. Let's look at a film. Now I think this one, let's see if it works. Ah, now that is Gilgen Gelzer. Who's actually, I wanted to show you somebody in action. Yeah, I can make it bigger and I can do all sorts of great things. Yeah. That is somebody making a woodcut. This is what you call a piece of wood on the wall that I've drilled to the wall, and he's using an electric hand drill, and he is directly, there you go. Let's see, yeah, the woodcut. So, wait a second. Let me see that again. That was cool. There we go. I haven't seen this in a long time. And this is this was a crazy series. I don't know why I started with this, but whatever. Here we are. And this is not for a book. This is to make big images. And this image actually was shown for 5 months at the Musée des Beaux-Arts de Caen, and just stopped last September 1st. And that's him actually doing it. I'm showing you mostly not images that are finished. I'm showing you the process, okay? And this should be the Korean artist called Lee Ufan, if I remember, where he is etching a huge etching plate. Now that's copper etching, where you go into it, and he's making these very minimalistic lines. And it's a whole thing about concentration. And the plate is, you won't see it because I'm not a good, these are all pictures by me, and I'm not a cinematographer, nor a photographer that Anka must be, but hey, it's okay. Those are my two videos, so that was cool. Now, here we have Mr. Lee. There's Lee Ufan working on a gigantic etching plate that's 6 meters long by 40 centimeters, 50 centimeters high. And this was last year. This is 2019. And it's a book, in a sense, because it's a scroll. You know, it's a print that's 6 meters long, 40 centimeters wide, and then on Japanese paper. And then we roll it into like a champagne box type of box. And the idea is that it's one huge work of art, of these very minimalistic lines of this very minimalistic abstract painter. And we made 18 copies of it. And it sold around 50,000 euros for one. So that's money, you know. I didn't publish it, unfortunately or not. Yeah. And here is another Mr. Lee. Oh, that's Mr. Lee in small. Yeah.
Oh, that's amazing.
That was this year, 2019 also. This is the installation of this incredibly outrageous project that we did with a French-Algerian painter called Jamel Tata for the Musée des Arts et Métiers in Paris. And it's still up now. It's in front of Foucault's pendulum in the chapel, Le Pendule de Foucault. which you could, well, you can't understand it, but it's right there behind. And the museum commissioned the artist to make, think of an idea of what to put in front of Foucault's pendulum. And so we worked on this, this crazy idea of making an 8-meter by 5-meter woodcut. Woodcut that's on both sides, that's double face, and that would be hanging in the middle of the room between the arcades in front of the pendulum as a sort of a counterpoint to the pendulum. And that is the same picture. And so this is when we are installing it. And right before, and we've printed on fabric. It's a sort of a see-through fabric. And that's the artist with one of my printers who are just doing a few little touch-ups before it actually goes up, you know. And there were three bands like that, so in the end it was 4 meters 50 by 8 meters. And there you see the opening, that was the opening day, and it sits there in the middle of, you see, it sort of sits in the middle of the room like that. And that's something we did one copy of, because when you make things by hand, you don't have to produce only 1,000, you can also do it just once for these very specific, different type of installations. Yeah.
Excuse me, Michael, what happens to this when the exhibition is over? Because it's unless a museum buys it.
Not at all.
It's just because of the
size. No, no, what happens is it belongs to the artist, mm-hmm. and it all goes into a crate, and it gets thrown into a truck, and the truck drives to his studio, and he puts it away in his studio until the next time there's a show for it. That's the idea. So here we had two artists right now working, this is actually now at my place, two remarkable women who are very intense drawers. And they're working on stone. You see those slabs? That's stone, and that's what we call lithographic stone. And they're drawing on there just like you draw on a piece of paper with pencils or with ink kind of like Indian ink, if you want to do liquid brush stuff. And they're drawing these very intensely sophisticated compositions. Oops, well, that's a whole other thing. So we're going to go back. And I noticed that way up here, where is it again? I noticed that way up here, that is the result of a Melanie. Melanie de la Trevoque. Nope, not at all. Sorry. This is going to be fun. Where do I go up? Up. Yeah, there. Isn't that it? There we go. So I noticed that it was a top image. There we go. Wow. I brought all that? You're kidding me. There we go. Come here, Sheba. Right. That's an image by Mélanie de la Trevoque that she was working on when the picture was taken. It's a... okay. Anka, how many colors in that picture? How many printing passes?
Two.
Bravo. That was good. This is a... One of four of a series of four that is about this big, about that big, the idea of preparing food, the preparation of food. And in this case, it was a series on the preparation of the squid. And then it should probably be here, right? Nope, come on. Nope, same one, sorry.
Oh, you maybe go.
Nah, because then I don't know which one it is. That one, really? That was 185, 184? That was the same one? Okay, I'm trying to find. Right, of course, this is going to be interesting. Maybe this one? Nah. All right, well, I was trying to find Mirka's image. This is going to be our slightly. Improvised defective quality of not seeing which image is which. This is my studio. Welcome to my studio. Was the studio before. This is part, you can see three presses there. One, two, three. Three presses, and the first one is a etching press, it's a huge etching press, because it's 3 meters by a meter 50, possibility of format. I mean, you could pass that thing, no problem. That's small. And behind are the lithographic presses with the stars, you know, the star thing. And this was also at my place, Anka was mentioning it. We do many different activities that we invite the public to. This was during a show, an exhibition, where we were back in, I don't know, 2-3 years ago, of recent works that had been published with different artists. And you see a vitrine on the inking table of several of the books. So that's our first sneak preview. There we go, the studio again, while we're in the midst of working with one of the huge format series with the American guy called Jim Dine, who also had a big show here in the Musée des Beaux-Arts de Caen. So we're all connected here between Woolworth and Caen, frankly, I find. Jamel Tata, the same one who did the works in the Musée des Arts et Métiers, this was 10 years ago, when we're drying the prints were so big, we had to pin them everywhere as we were in the midst of the process of printing it. It had something like 11 passes. Marc Desgranchons, French painter, this is also an image that's not finished and that's drying on the walls because, you know, the ink is so, there's so much stuff on the paper that you've got to put them between drying sheets. And when it's that big, because that is about a third bigger than this, well, you don't have any place to put them, so you hang them on the wall everywhere and wait for them to dry. How many colors here, Anka?
Four.
Not bad. Not bad. Two.
No.
Two. And the image ended up with maybe six colors in the end. So you're starting to get the idea of layering. You know, you have the blue, and here you have the red that comes on top of the blue.
And the black.
And, well, of course, my photography is so poor, but the dark tones is a superimposition of the blue and the red together.
Okay, see.
I got you on that one. Mm-hmm. And then you put some yellow in there, and you get, and it goes completely nuts. This is also a view of the studio with at a moment of an exhibition.
The sink.
The sink, yeah, there's the sink. I'm sorry I don't have a close-up for you of the sink. Yeah, you get another view of the studio. You could even see up here the squid series that I showed you, that one actually, of before. Mélanie de l'Entrevocte, yeah. Okay, so now we might be getting into some of the artists that are working. This is a formidable Austrian artist from Vienna. Christian Schwarzwald is his name. And he's making what we call a monotype. I put this in here to show different styles of different works. Monotype is the artist paints on a, well, in the 19th century, you used to do it on a piece of glass. Now you do it on plexiglass. So you paint printing ink onto plexiglass, and you do your whole cuisine. And then I take that plate and put it on the press, put paper on top of it, and pass it under pressure. And as you can see, there's some really huge formats there. Here we have a French artist, Frédéric Lutz, who's touching up a lithographic print of hers of a Gison, where, and this is a huge format also, where she's adding by hand in watercolor and pen and ink more stuff on the print itself. So the print becomes a unique piece afterwards. And there you have the final version of it, you see. The final version. And that was just an unbelievably beautiful piece. And she made, if I remember, maybe 7 different versions, because we print the body in black 7 or 10 times. And so each time she would come use it as new fodder for creation. She would just completely transform it and make an original piece out of it. There's the Schwarzwald you had seen before, and those were a lot of the very intense results from his monotypes. Monotypes, you can put several colors at the same time because you're just doing it once. Now, I've got other questions for Anka here coming up. Marie-Ange Guimino, French, I'd say more conceptual artist, and that was shown at the XXL show, that whole series here in Caen. And these, the images on the wall are from photographic base, and that's her talking with me when that was a long time ago.
You're not going to ask me how many colors there are on the table.
No. That's no fun. No, and see some of the books in the vitrines, some of the images in the back, Bertrand Lavier in the back, Marc Desgranchons, Jim Dine. And this is in the wrong way. Hup. There we go. Marc Desgranchons is a very, I like this picture because it's extremely austere and extremely solemn, but that's what you do. You draw on a piece of wood, n'importe quoi, on a stone, and like you do on a piece of paper. Oop, that one also went the wrong way, but it's kind of interesting.
The stones,
when we finish the project, when it's signed and numbered by the artist and everything is done, we put them on a table specific for that, and we actually erase the image with sand and water with an abrasion, you know, an abrasion polishing effect, and we reuse the stone. So it's super recycling.
No,
because you're actually removing a little layer on the stone, so it becomes virgin once again.
Joanna
Drucker, yeah. That was this is some of the readings. I guess I put some of the readings on there because it's the same space you've been seeing every time, you know, and it just morphs into all sorts of stories here. And there's another reading. That's Jim Dine, who's there with the public, giving one of his performances way back when. That was a long time ago.
On YouTube. I don't know if
all
the others.
Yeah, it probably is. Here is a story about making a book. This is a book by American artist called William McKendry. William McKendry, that's him also. I've done 2 books with him. This one here, this was from 1989. That was in 2009, maybe, where we devised together a kind of a travel book. He went to spend the summer in the country of Iceland, and he took with him, which I prepared, lithographic transfer sheets, kind of like a sketchbook, okay? And he would paint compositions all around his trip in Iceland, witnessing all of the landscapes in Iceland that interested him. And at the end, we put it all together in a book, except for the problem is that there is so much material. You see, those are all the transfer sheets on the wall that then I would put onto my lithographic matrix to be able to print. But to start with, we had maybe 300 different compositions, and the book is supposed to be 24 pages. So how to make a book with all of that extra information? And so we put everything up on the wall after a first selection, and we start to think, well, okay, maybe this one goes with this one, and we start creating a rhythm of images, one after the other. That's how you do it. This was a black and white book. Oh, there's a couple colors in it, but it's pretty, you know, it's about the Icelandic volcanic intensity of the earth there. And actually, instead of using Indian ink, which was he was supposed to use on the tracing papers, which is what's on the wall, he discovered that all of Iceland soil is black. So he took the volcanic sand and mixed it with gum arabic into a fluid, and use that to paint on the papers instead of real Indian ink. So it was really crusty. It was very, very, it had relief on it. But we're doing two-dimensional books, so it was all about how to transfer that technically onto a matrix. It's I hope I'm getting you lost a bit here. That's good. Yeah, there we got McKendry pondering over what on earth are we going to do? And some of them here, you can see the pages here. We're starting to make proofs, and we're starting to figure it out. This is total improvisation. There's no, this is a real livre de peintre. There's no real thought process of how you turn the pages before you're in front of all of the elements. And once you're in front of all the elements, you start figuring it out, in a sense. You start figuring it out. And that's fantastic. It's just the most extraordinary moment there. And that's what the book kind of looks like in the end. The text in there are simply Icelandic names of the places he draws, you know. And of course, the language being so absurd for us people over here, it looked like the best text to use for this book. Yeah. Jim Dine at it with the chainsaw, because you saw Gelzer earlier with the electric drill. Well, Dine is also a big advocate for electric machinery, and he carves his woodcuts. That's a piece of wood. It's a piece of plywood, ordinary plywood. And he's starting up this whole composition with a chainsaw. He's a master of chainsaw, absolute master. And we also play ping pong on the press. That one escaped me right there. It's what we call press pong. And in French, it's called ping pong no limite. It's very, and we also prepare food, because when we make openings, we'll give something, and drinks, and so the whole team, that's my team there, they were all making the canapes and everything, and that's a beautiful moment also. Not very many. Mm-hmm. We're four, and then we have interns, so maybe it's five, maybe it's six. It's pretty hard to be more than six, sometimes been seven, but during the Liu Fan project that I showed earlier, we were seven because I had to hire extra people. The project was so vast, we needed more arms and legs, and we needed more technically capable people also. It was so outrageous. But yes, Jim Dine, kind of like Frederick Lutz you saw earlier doing her Gison, he's painting on each proof. So we hang everything up, and he's painting in the nose, the pink that you're seeing, he's painting that every time. That's what interested him for this specific image. Other times he won't paint or won't intervene. In this case, that's what he wanted to do.
Are these the ones that are in the spinocchios that are in the collection here?
No, because the ones here are that big, and it's a book. Mm-hmm. It's a book.
Yeah.
That a bit big for a book, but hey. Jean-François Morige, very great French abstract painter, who's there working on how to position his reds. You see, over here you can see the red that's coming down on the image, and there he's just trying to understand how he's going to position the sort of pinkish color that's going to come from behind the image, because these are all on Japanese papers that have translucidity.
Good coordination with the shirt.
Yeah.
Two colors.
That was two colors. There we go. Yep, that one's good. Charles-Henri de Fouchécourt, extraordinary specialist of Persian literary, where we did a night of reading on Persian poetry, and he is one of the most extraordinary human beings I probably ever met. He was 85 at the time. I don't even know if he's still alive. And these are pages from one of the original 1001 Nights books that was published in 1910 that we put as a backdrop to him. Günter Damisch, another extraordinary Viennese Austrian painter. Here we were working for this big show that was at the Albertina Museum in Vienna. Of a solo show of his, of these huge formats, and it's all the same space. You can see, you can start recognizing. That's also Damisch, where he's we're working on these huge formats. It was great. Richard Gorman, Irish abstract painter, and a series of small images that we produced about a year and a half ago. Okay, so no, they're too small. I can't do a question to Anka on that one. Liu Fan, etching small plates. At the time, he had done this. He had been invited to do the invited artist at the Chateau de Versailles, and took over the whole gardens and everything. And we did a series with him of small etchings that were all on copper like that. And it's kind of nice because it looks like a mirror in a sense, you know. Carole Benzaken, French artist, and you see the stone up close. She's painting or drawing on stone. And there's Carole again. She's actually using kind of sort of charcoal effect. And the images you see are starting to appear on the wall there, but you don't see that much. So yeah, we're improvising here. This is good. I like this. Gilgian Gelzer, again, in front of his huge formats, where we put everything up on the walls so that afterwards he would put colored pencil in each of them. They're all in this sort of lead pencil printed effect. Blaise Drummond, Irish painter, remarkable, who's starting a composition of a tree. You might see, there you see the tree printed here behind him. There he's working on a big concept there. That's a work table. You know, you've got a mess. My place is messy. It's always full of stuff that we can barely control at times. That's how Blaise Drummond makes a woodcut. He stands on top of the wood and jumps up and down and breaks the plywood so he can get these different kind of weird effects from it. And then he starts carving in. Up, Damisch is on the wrong side, doesn't matter. Marc Desgranchamps, who was composing some of his different things, and that's me printing a small Pinocchio for a book. That is one page in a book, a Pinocchio page, yeah. And Marc Desgranchamps was working behind in the same thing. This was our second book with Jim Dine on Pinocchio. Beautiful little thing, beautiful. Dine coming to paint the proofs, I know. And here is a whole series, I think, is going to come up of photos by a real photographer. This is a guy called Bernard Plussu, and who did a whole sort of reportage type of thing on the shop for his own, not for anything, but just for his own pleasure. But probably these are the only ones where you actually see real stories of how we work. That's the ink on the roller, the team who's managing the huge sheets, bringing the copies around so that they get processed again. And of course, we're out now in Back in Color and back in my lousy photographs with Brecht Evans, the very flamboyant Flemish comic book author, and who started with us about 4 years ago and has done these really incredible images. Lee Ufan back at it with his copper. Jamel Tata, who's very casual, working on his big images, talking on the phone, painting the Matrix at the same time. Yeah, and that's Tata also starting new composition in large formats. Large formats are cool to show because at least you see something, you know. If I'm going to start showing these little things where we do little miniatures, you can't see anything. Jean-François Maurice always paints his stones on the floor. We have him on the floor and he starts working like that on the floor. There's Schwarzwald again moving on his big monotypes. You see the roller here that's full of bands of color and that you can find here on the plate before he puts his black on top. I hope all this is algebra because you're not supposed to know how all this happens. Émilie Pitoisé, French, more conceptual artist. I think I put this here because it's a whole other method of thinking. She just stayed with us for a while and thought about how to make an image with all of our tools. And because she doesn't draw, she doesn't paint, she comes to things in a very different way, I'd say. And we got an idea together that we would wet a tulle, a voile, in water, and she would bring it to the press and throw it on, lift it up, and lift it up onto the metal matrix and let it fall down slowly on the sheet and let it sit there for a couple seconds, take it up, and then we ink the sheet, we ink the metal plate, and that's the image. And it's sort of like revealing the trace of a veil that's fallen on a piece of metal. Gelser again. Anyway, yeah. And that's a Plosu picture. So you've seen a bit. I mean, this can go on forever and ever and ever. But what we keep on doing is to get people involved, and they're from all ages and all different types of careers. And we try and get everybody excited, you know. These are not professional printmakers. They're not professional etchers or professional lithographers or anything like that. They're just artists. And that's what sort of interests me, because the artists who don't know how to do printmaking generally do what you're not supposed to do. And when you do something you're not supposed to do, well, there can be really wonderful surprises. It's tricky at times, but the surprises is what I'm looking for, to make something that's fresh, that has some meaning, that explodes on the paper, on the sheet. You can't always do it in a very controlled, conventional method. Sometimes you need something that goes off the wall a bit, and then it can come alive, you know. Then it can come alive. Since we have the privilege of working strictly by hand and doing production in very small numbers, we can permit ourselves to do that type of thing. And it's great. And it's great. Where do you want me to take this from here? What more is there? There's a million hours more. Except for my desire to go back to Quinéville and see the beach over there, which I miss terribly. It's a wonderful area over there, and not that far.
We see there's a glass ceiling, which is interesting because you can take advantage of daylight, which is probably much better than working with the electric light.
The story is that the printing presses have to be, in my mind, under electric light, but where the artists work is where you have the daylight. Mm-hmm. And when we do all the color, we start doing new proofs and we start mixing color and everything, we'll always bring it out to the daylight, mm-hmm. underneath the skylight. But when you're printing, you want to have a stable, consistent light, you know. And when you're under a big skylight like we have, it changes too much. Mm-hmm. And also the temperature changes too much. In winter, it's going to be really cold. In the summer, it's way too hot. All those considerations. It's not good to be under daylight for the presses. It's very good for the artists, mm-hmm. in that sense.
Two-story building?
Yeah, but we're all on one floor. Ground floor. We're all on one floor. Yeah. Yep. We're all on one floor, and it's 200 square meters, and there are several areas. There are six printing presses, five people working constantly, and the artists on top, and all of that. And it's a the whole thing about. Making it all as fluid as possible so you don't lose too much time. Time is a major factor. Although we are big, slow cookers, you still have to get a job done in a defined amount of time, 3 days, 2 weeks, 3 months, a half a day, depending on what it is, of course. In order to, I don't know, I guess the silly thing you say is time is money. If we spend too long on a project, then we can't start another one. We're going to start losing a little bit of potential there, and we won't be able to do as much work during the course of the year as we should, in order to produce to get to the deadlines. But it works in general. It works enough. It's not so bad. It's not so bad considering that, once again, it's all about slowness, you know. And which is also a major privilege in the world we live today, you know.
And would the job be different if you worked in the U.S.?
No, it wouldn't be different. No, it's the same. They have the same types of places in the States. It's all about your mentality. What's your character? What are you aiming for? Who are you interested in? What's your approach to printmaking and publishing? And there are wonderful, wonderful people everywhere, including in the United States. You know, and then there's a lot more activity in America than there is in France, which was the contrary when I first arrived. France, by far, had the most production diversity and intensity, much more than any other country in the world. And of course, that was right after the 1970s, and all the economy went down, and the consumers left France, or the French stopped consuming, in any case. And so all the printing places pretty much disappeared. When I arrived in 79, I was told there's about 20% of print shops left in Paris since the Second World War. And now, I think there's about 20% left of what I knew when I started. But there is a whole new renaissance happening right now, where during the 90s, digital came out, and all the schools started closing their print classes, their print departments, and replacing the presses with computers everywhere, and starting to do digital prints and all that jazz. And that was great. And there was a major lull. I never had anybody French come to me to want to be an intern for 20 years. nobody was interested really in that. And then somehow things started, society changes, society evolves, and now the print departments in France are exploding to the extent that they refuse people. They don't have enough infrastructure to accept as many students. And I'm getting calls all week long for people who want to do internship from all over France. And now, also, to get back to my thread beforehand, we are seeing new operations that are coming up of print shops in France of people under 35 years old. Both do publishing and printing and all that at the same time. It's becoming a much, much more a bigger movement right now. And we'll see if there's a market, if people can make a living out of it, if stuff sells, if people find the right clients for all this, it'll keep growing. There's something, in the United States, it's absolutely intense in the past 10, 12 years, how many print operations have all of a sudden come out of nowhere. A lot dealing with letterpress. Letterpress is very big, traditional letterpress, to make beautiful books and posters and stuff like that, but also litho shops, etching shops, combining digital together, which I do also. It's about a choice of life. I think a lot of people just can't take it when they're 28 and they've gone through their studies to go into an office job all day long, and they have some form of creativity in them. And so a lot of them and it goes a little bit with sort of the organic world, the whole bio thing going on at the same time. We want to use our hands. We want to be in a more real situation, which doesn't mean... And all these people were born with a computer in their left hand. They know all that by much better than I do. But there is something that's growing that's very real now, and that people use it as a choice of life, and they find different ways of existing with it, different ways of getting funding, different ways of finances and commerce, but it's a very healthy way of life. And somewhere, I'm in the art world. And the art world is a big, complex monster that throws tons and tons of money around. The galleries, the museums, the art centers, the collectors, the auction houses, the artists, obviously. All that swoops up billions and billions and billions. The last frontier that is still remains healthy in the art world, really, 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 is the print publishing world. There's, the egos are different. The money is less... outstanding, the money is less screaming all the time. That creates so much stories and problems eventually, And the artists are there to work directly in the creative process. Obviously, we're thinking about if this is going to sell eventually, how is that going to happen? But during the process, it's not the problem. And so we're all in it together to make it work. Even artists who have a really terrible temper or a bad character, they're easy when they're at the studio. They're easy. With me, it flows. The narcissism and the egos are in a different league, in a sense, compared to when they're dealing with their own gallerists or agents or museum directors. It's different. So I still find that for the moment, the print world is still a very healthy world to be in, and that's great. Another one of those privileges. But yeah, maybe I show these things. Do we have time? I mean, what time is it?
Oh,
Right. Yeah, yeah, no, no. Questions? Please. Water, questions? In French, Spanish, or English, however you want to do it. I can manage easily.
Are you a collector or an amateur of ancient books, illustrated books?
I don't have that type of money. I don't have that type of course, what I can find, yeah, sure, of course. Yeah, and I mean, I definitely look at things a lot. I collect what I can in the flea markets, in those type of things. I don't go in auction to look for books, or I don't go to book dealers to buy books necessarily, because I don't have that type of money. But I do have a number of ouvrages from the 18th and 19th century, etching mostly, but lithography also, that are wonderful. I love printed matter that you find in simple printed matter that you find in the brocantes and the flea markets, for very little money, and fantastic things. The posters, the postcards, the little books that were made at the time, the advertising. There's some extraordinary things that still are available for nothing now. In terms of the really beautiful books, I definitely don't have the economy for that. Yeah. Yeah. I have a few things, though. Hey, you know. Sometimes I can make trades with dealers. I definitely was able to get a few things that I was hoping for. But, you know, I started doing this business also because I wanted to have art in my place, and I didn't have any money for it. So after all, working with the artists, I would always get, you know, well, I wanted art from the artists that I worked with, that I would call in because I really love what they're doing. And that's how I make my collection, is by working with the people I admire, and at least I'm going to get something from them, because I make it myself, après tout, you know. And that's great. Yeah, yeah.
And you're meant, oops, sorry.
Do you work Saturdays and Sundays?
Oh, yes.
This is why you're under pressure.
Yes.
Oh, also, apropos of under pressure, the poster. Maybe you can tell us, because somebody before the text was on the poster said, oh yeah, because he's a painter. And actually, can you explain what you were doing on the poster?
That is what you call a it's like a nuancier. These are different color samples of inks that I was mixing up for a specific artist, for a specific image, and you know, the ink is just like this globby texture that's all oily. So you take a piece of paper and you rub it on it a bit, and then on the big sheet you rub back the color on it to see what it looks like before you put it on the roller and before you try it out on the image. It's a nuancier sheet. And that was for the British artist called Alan Jones, and where we did this intense thing with him about 8 years ago, and he was great. He was great because he was old school. He was old school. He was somebody that had learned how to make lithography in color. I'm talking about color images. He knows how to make a color image. It's an education how to break down your image into 5-6 color passes and makes it all come together to be this one stunning thing. And he's probably one of the only ones that I worked with who actually had an education in that. He was a teacher in it in the 50s in London. That's how before he became a big British pop star, that's how he earned his living. You know, I mean, pop artist star. He was not a singer. No, not Alan. Yeah.
Bertrand, you had a question?
Yes, Yes, you mentioned different styles of printing, etching, lithography, woodcut, monotype. Are some of them more fashionable than others, or is there something regular about them?
No.
Have you noticed any change or evolution?
Nope, none whatsoever. It all depends about the intention.
Mm-hmm.
What is the intention? When you start a conversation with an artist, because I guess I could add to all of this spewing out that I've been doing, that nobody comes to my place with a model of something they're going to try to reproduce or get close to. People come, that all of them that you've been seeing there, they come just with ideas in their head. They might do a few little preliminary sketches. They don't come with a painting. They don't come with a watercolor and say, I'm going to do this. No, never. It's all from scratch in that sense. And that's a kind of an important thing. So there's no real, you know, obviously there'll be cycles where for various reasons we'll be doing all of a sudden a whole season of more woodcuts than etchings, and inversely, and more lithographies than woodcuts. But it's more about what each technique can bring. What does it bring to the construction of the image? If you need to put litho and woodcut and etching all together in the same, well, you'll do it, because you can mix them all together. It's all the same inks, after all. There's no, it's not about, it's about the final result.
So does the artist have a clear idea of the type of print they want, or you discuss?
Enough. But then during the discussion, we might veer it, saying, maybe we should, this would sound better in linoleum, or in monotype, or in God knows what. Things can evolve as you go along. But yes, there, you know, I said, I'd like to make five lithographs at this size. You know, the conversation starts about size and paper quality and ambition of maybe how many colors we could put on. The conversation starts like that and saying, I'd like to do a series on this subject matter. A lot of times people have documents, base documents for drawing or for painting, photographs, and so they'll start showing me their photographs, not of their work, but of documentation. You know, like you saw the squid with the knife across it. You know, she started showing me this book she had, which was unbelievable, where it had scenes like that, and I said, I want to start using that, and so we, you know, I said, okay, let's get it to this size here. Wouldn't that be good? We're on this type of paper that has that type of aura. And then once we did the first proofs, then we decided to put the frame, the sort of blue-green flat frame around it, where you guessed it was two colors, which was very good. You passed with flying colors on that one. But I've got more things to test you on. Yes. Yeah, it's a discussion. Since there's no precise model beforehand, and we'll offer all the techniques simultaneously, whatever works. There was a Woody Allen film that had that title a couple years ago, Whatever Works. It was pretty much the same idea, you know. Whatever makes it happen. And sometimes we don't really know it before we're in it. Yeah, yeah.
That's why I pointed out in the beginning that the role we have very, you rarely are aware of the role of the printer in the making of a book or of a print, and that it's always a dialogue between the artist and.
Yeah, the same way in a recording studio, you don't necessarily see what a producer does, or the sound engineer, the subtleties of it all. You just listen to the damn song, which is great. I know. It's very, very similar in that sense.
And what I think it's important for our students is that you pointed out a whole series of things that we are not, we discuss here more of abstract things, yeah? About books, about history, but rarely about the profession and the whole spectrum of aspects that the profession covers, so that that talk can be an example for you, not necessarily for that specific profession, but for another kind of profession where you need passion, creativity, the craft. Sometimes physical, yeah, the physical aspect. Physical. We don't associate the making of books or art. There is this idea that art is something, you know, that just comes from the sky, very physical. And also the material aspect, because you see all this is material. There are colors. There are the stones, nobody makes a present, you know. You have to buy them, and you have to rent a space, you have to pay the people. So all these things we are tended to be shy and not discuss about money, but it's surviving, you know, it's a surviving condition. And
I am sort of the proof that it can happen. It can work, you know, enough in any case. Lab, definitely. Yes, no, we're not. It's not a factory. It's a visual lab, for sure. Yeah. Yeah, it's the thing. You know, we're set up for that. We're not set up for a factory. I work with mechanical studios, mechanical shops, that have automatic or semi-automatic presses that use electricity. There's no electricity in my place. We don't use electricity.
You save the planet.
I don't know. I won't save the planet, but there's no electricity. The other places, it's more of a factory style. But when you're dealing in art circles, it still remains very different than the notion of factory, even in the mechanized studios. It's still, you know, pretty human for that. Yeah. And they're worthwhile seeing, too. There's some incredible things in those places. So France was really top of the line for so long and has made some of the most beautiful and effective presses. And they're still around, you know, they're still around, you still can find them. It's great. My presses are from the late 1800s. I never repair them. They never break down. I just put a little bit of oil or grease here and there. I don't know how to make a press or to repair a press. I have no idea, but they never break down. It was all conceived during the Industrial Revolution, where things were made to last. And with the really intelligent, simple friction things, where things don't get worn down, you see. Or if they do, well, they still work anyway. The materials were noble, the materials were solid. And it's really impressive. I never do anything to my presses. And God knows how many thousands and thousands and thousands of passes they've had, and I don't even want to know before they came to me how many thousands they had. It's scary. It's scary, yeah.
They're also very beautiful.
Yeah, they have a certain
sculpture.
Kind of torture machines too, you know.
Yeah.
Je voulais vous demander, on a vu que vous aviez des ouvriers, quoi, des gens qui travaillaient dans votre atelier. Il y a combien de personnes ?
Quatre.
Quatre personnes.
Ouais, on est quatre. Il y a trois salariés en plus de moi, et puis il y a les stagiaires.
D'accord.
Qui
comment
sont
un peu,
comment c'est ?
Comment ça se répartit le travail ?
Ah bah tous les autres, c'est l'équipe. c'est-à-dire qu'ils s'occupent exclusivement de la partie technique, de l'impression. Ils font le travail avec les artistes et moi-même pour produire les œuvres sur les machines. Ils font les rouleaux, ils tournent les roues, etc. Ils préparent les matrices. Ce sont des imprimeurs. Ils font la partie impression. Moi, je fais le reste. Par exemple, venir ici aujourd'hui et faire le joli cœur. C'est tout. Ou autre ribambelle. Je fais leur truc aussi et je les forme, je les entraîne, je les éduque dans tout ça et certains comprennent au fur et à mesure. Yes, yes, yes.
L'Opéra Bastille doit être à proximité de votre atelier.
Il est adjacent.
Est-ce que vous avez été amené à travailler pour faire des décors ou des choses comme ça pour l'opéra, non ?
Non, pas encore. Mm-hmm. Mais quelle heure est-il ?
Pas encore. Des images on the wall.
Yeah. I don't know. We'll see. No, we have not. But we work with other things, but not the Bastille. I think they have enough problems on their own over there. Mm-hmm. But I go to see the opera, so it's great. It's great.
Qui m'avait envoyé un mail qui voulait s'orienter vers la profession? Oui, Mathilde.
Parce qu'en fait, du coup, je réfléchis à ce que je peux faire après mon master. Et l'idée de m'orienter vers l'art est possible, sauf que comme c'est un master en anglais de recherche, je réfléchis s'il faut faire une école d'art ou faire un master en art. Je sais pas.
Ça, vous êtes dans de beaux draps, vous, tiens. Ça, alors là, ça dépend. Vous êtes artiste ?
Je fais de la photo, mais je ne dirais pas que je suis artiste, c'est un artiste.
Donc, vous voulez aller dans le domaine artistique sans être forcément artiste, n'est-ce pas ? Que je déconseille vivement, bien entendu. C'est terrible, hein, comme truc, d'être artiste. En revanche, dans tout le monde de l'art, il y a des milliers de voix et qui sont, si on a de la chance, qui peuvent être vraiment étonnants. Je crois que maintenant, la culture emploie plus que l'industrie automobile en France. Mais on n'augmente pas le budget de la culture, néanmoins. Peu importe. Vous avez toutes les écoles, évidemment, pour devenir artiste, comme les arts déco et les beaux-arts. Mais vous avez également tout ce qu'on appelle l'ingénierie, l'économie de l'art, ingénierie culturelle. Et ça se développe beaucoup, ça. À la Sorbonne, ils ont des départements pour ça. Il y a des écoles privées qui ne sont pas si mauvaises, qui font ce genre de choses. Je veux dire, ça, c'est pour travailler après dans les maisons de vente aux enchères, dans les galeries, dans les sociétés qui développent des projets avec l'urbanisme et les artistes, ou pour tenir des salons d'art, pour travailler sur des organisations d'événements, de l'événementiel. Il y a plein de choses. Après, musée, construire des expositions, on devient conservateur. Et conservateur, en France, en général, pour avoir un poste dans un musée comme à Caen, là, il faut être conservateur, il faut avoir fait l'école du Louvre, avoir traversé toutes les épopées pour avoir ce titre. Et après, une fois que vous avez eu le diplôme à la Noix, il faut être engagé. Quelque part, il faut qu'il y ait des places qui se libèrent, toujours pareil. La culture n'est pas très différente du reste de la société, n'est-ce pas? Mais oui, il y a des choses splendides à faire avec ça. Après, vous êtes dans le beau drap. Ah. Ouais, mais vous avez les facts d'histoire de l'art. Ça, c'est assez légion. Il y a des choses merveilleuses là-dedans, dans l'histoire de l'art. Alors, l'histoire de l'art, ça amène ou à aller effectivement plus vers le côté conservateur, ou vers les critiques d'art, les choses comme ça, ou. Ouais, je vais en oublier, et puis ils vont être fâchés en plus si je les oublie. Enfin, oui. Et ça grandit beaucoup, hein, les possibilités. Dire que les bas salaires sont géniaux, non, dans la culture. Il y a toujours. Oui, il faut commencer, et puis après, on se débrouille. Il faut commencer, quoi. Mais on reçoit beaucoup de monde de toutes les écoles. Évidemment, chez moi, c'est plutôt des beaux-arts et art déco Paris ou région, parce que c'est plus des artistes en herbe qui viennent chez moi. Mais on a parfois des gens des écoles de mode, du design, des écoles de photo aussi, et puis les facs d'art, quoi, les histoires de l'art, qui peuvent venir pour être imbibés dans un, si je peux dire, c'est vraiment très justement décrit, imbibés dans l'encre, enfin dans la fabrication, dans le vif. Et oui, mais c'est comme ça. Et moi, tous l'équipe, ils viennent tous parce qu'ils ont fait des stages chez moi et qu'on s'est bien entendu et qu'ils viennent des beaux-arts ou des arts déco en général. Et ils étaient dingues de ça, dingues d'impression. Et une chose a conduit vers une autre, quoi. Et les équipes évoluent aussi, enfin, voilà.
Ils ont des stages de combien de temps après ?
Les beaux-arts, c'est généralement 3 mois. Plus c'est long, mieux c'est. Les Américains, ça peut être 6 mois, 1 an, ceux qui viennent des facs américains. Sinon, c'est 1 semaine pour les stages d'observation, pour les gens les 16-17 ans, ou ça peut être 1 mois, enfin, voilà, c'est selon... selon le style de possibilités aussi. Pour nous, plus c'est long, mieux c'est. Parce que chaque fois, il faudrait redire un peu les ABC de comment on fait, quoi. Mais enfin, on connaît la musique très bien. C'est les gens qui viennent chez nous, ils s'intègrent petit à petit dans une équipe autour de la presse, quoi. Ils commencent à comprendre les mouvements, les gestes, et on leur explique, évidemment. Mais c'est, ouais, petit à petit, on prend de la confiance et on y va, quoi. On est toujours bien pour avoir des petites mains. Il y a toujours plein de choses à faire pour des petites mains qui, justement, à cause de ça, prennent confiance par la suite et grandissent, n'est-ce pas ? Ouais.